It was not you who chose me, but I who chose you. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. My guest today is Father Jerry Lessard. He's a Dominican. He entered the Dominican province of the Order of Preachers in 1978 and was ordained to the priesthood in 1984. He's an old friend of mine. Father Jerry and I first met while he was writing a thesis on Jacques Maritain for his licentiate in sacred theology, and we got to know each other over the years by attending annual meetings of the American Maritain Association. We lost touch for a while, and we met again in D.C., where he is the parochial vicar of St. Dominic Church in the Federal Center of Washington. He's also spent some years as a web designer, creating sites for monasteries in Hollywood and in Rome. I'll tell you, because I know him, he's really an artist by nature, a guitarist, he plays the electric bass, he's a photographer and a poet. He's modest about his poetic achievement, which is quite fine, but he hopes to get better with age. What I want to talk to Father Jerry about is that since 2007, he's been showing films at his parish in downtown D.C., starting with Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Father Jerry, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And you're an old friend, so we can just have a heart-to-heart here about the Lord of the Rings and other films that you've been showing. And is there some particular reason why you started your film series at St. Dominic's in Washington with the Lord of the Rings?
Well, before I moved here to St. Dominic's, I was out in Youngstown, Ohio, and someone came from Walsh University looking for teachers and figured I'll go to the Dominican Priory. And he suggested that I teach a course on the Lord of the Rings and tie it to the documents of the church like Lumen Gentium and Vatican II and things like that and make a course out of it. And I agreed to do that. But I was moved, reassigned to St. Dominic's before I ever had a chance to do that.
That was a pretty big jump.
So I think I might as well do it anyways, but now I don't have to give assignments. I don't have to give examinations.
Or you don't have to grade papers.
I don't have to answer to the dean. You know, I can just do it freely.
Yes, and I've been to that university, and, you know, you might have had to answer to more than that. But anyway, we'll pass that by. Father Jerry, if I tell you that I was deeply moved and grabbed by the first part of the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings, but then lost interest, am I a heretic?
Well, the second part is probably the hardest one to take, the whole battle scene and the Uruks and, you know, all these
all the CGI,
yeah,
just floating around,
and it's sort of the middle where you haven't gotten to the final happy ending yet, you know.
So we haven't gotten to redemption.
Right.
Well, I mean, have you found that, I mean, I noticed that when I read top 100 movies of all time, you know, you and I both read lists like that in movie magazine and so forth, Lord of the Rings is right there, the trilogy. In fact, among trilogies, it's one of the best four or five. I always hesitate when I see that thinking, you know, it lost me along the way. And The Godfather didn't lose me along the way. And I could name a few others, like, you know, the great trilogy by the Indian director, Sajat Raj. But do you find that others that you've watched this with had the same experience?
I know my parents didn't like it.
Didn't like it all or just got lost in it?
It wasn't for them, you know, because it wasn't sweet and innocent like they remembered movies in the past.
That's not the reason I got lost. I don't like sweet and innocent in movies.
No.
But what about the folks you sat down in the parish and watched it with? What was their reaction?
Well, they followed along. We interrupted after almost every scene and talked about scenes because we stretched it out for 24 weeks.
Wow. You
and
did.
And I showed
wow.
the full version, which is like 11 hours long, so there's much more subtlety in the character development. And then I showed all the documentaries that had to do with Tolkien himself.
Oh, that's good.
And with the script writers, how they translated the book, and even about music and costumes and art design and things like that. So we learned all about the movie, too, as we went along.
But, well, you know, Father, I'd like to invite you right now to write for the Christian Review, write up, you know, how I showed and explained and enjoy the Lord of the Rings with my parish and sort of give people a how-to, because it sounds like you packaged the whole thing in such a way that people weren't just passively watching it.
Well, it's not until you get to the very end and experience what Tolkien called a eucatastrophe. He used the prefix EU before the word catastrophe to describe a sudden, unexpected turn of events that was good rather than bad. And that's where you think the whole world is coming to an end, and then finally there is this redemption. It's like the resurrection. And it's a very uplifting and satisfying experience.
So, but your larger reason, I would imagine, as a parish priest, and I've known you for a long time and know where your head is, your larger reason was precisely to edify, uplift, and help people understand the chaos that they experience in their lives and in the world.
Yes, and they were also edified by Tolkien himself, who was a good Catholic. His son, he had one son who was a priest. He was very devout. And after the Bible, no books are read more than his.
Now, let's stop there. In other words, in terms of modern-day publishing, I guess, you know, ever since statistics have been kept, you're saying that next to the Holy Scripture, the ring cycle of J.R. Tolkien is the most widely read book in English? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think it's maybe all of his books. I think I read once that, yeah, including all the other books with Cimmerillion and other things, too.
Well, I better get reading because I must say I've
his friend,
you know, I devoured all of C.S. Lewis, but Tolkien, at least at the time in my life when I read it, it didn't grab me the way other great writers did. What age were you when you started reading Tolkien?
Well, I might have been in college when I read The Hobbit, but it was when I was a young dad, as we say in religious life, recently ordained, and I was working in New York City Hospital, and I didn't like New York. I didn't really know anybody, and I didn't really enjoy hospital ministry. So it was my way of escaping the jungle of the city, you know, and I would go into Middle Earth, and I read the whole...
Well, you could have just gone in the subway. But you found there something that fed your soul, I take it.
I did. It was a marvelous experience, you know. It was good over evil. And
you know, it's interesting. I guess the only book in my life comparable to that of fiction is Sigrid Undset's Kristin Lovren's Daughter, which I've read, I think, now three times. But each time I go back, and it's like Tolkien in a sense that it's an epic of an entire life of birth, the fall, sin, redemption. I mean, it covers the whole thing. But Tolkien is really covering the cosmos, and he has got a whole bunch of characters inside of it. How do you teach it? Do you teach it from the point of view of the whole or from the individual characters?
Well, I tried to get all the way back to creation when I was doing this. It takes God four verses to create the heavens and the earth. It took him, Tolkien, about 100 pages in his Silmarillion, you know.
Right.
It really gets into sort of the choirs of angels, but he has different names for them, you know, and he tries to make his fantasy believable by not making it too unreal, making it seem almost like the scriptures, like that these characters really did exist at one time, you know, and maybe they're just extinct now.
So it's a science fiction or it's not science fiction, that's not fair. It's a fantasy, but you don't feel as if you're completely detached from the reality we live in.
That's right. He thinks that because God is a creator and he created us in his image, we too are creators, and that our imagination is really like an extension of creation, that we can create with our imagination.
And, well, that's what artists do.
You know, and that what we create is real, in a sense.
Well, it is real, as you well know. And did you find that, did people come to the movie and then go read the book, or did you find that people who had read the book came to the movie? Was it 50-50?
I think most people had already read it.
So the fans of Tolkien came to the movie.
But, we get a lot of little old ladies too that come, and some of them had not read it.
God bless them.
Yeah.
God bless them.
Afterwards.
I've taught many a class at a parish, or back before when I was a Baptist at a church, where it was my quote unquote little old ladies who were the smartest people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, almost always. Never underestimate a little old lady, I'll tell you right now.
We have a homeless guy who never misses a movie.
Really?
He practically lives here at the church, and we trust him wholeheartedly. He's a very nice guy, very bright, and oftentimes I'll ask a question, and he's the only one who knows the answer.
Right.
He lives a life of leisure, going to all the museums, and he goes to free lectures and movies here at the Smithsonian. So he's almost like a classical philosopher.
He's Matthew Arnold's wandering scholar.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of actually presenting a film in a parish setting, films are usually an hour and a half or even longer. I'm sure Lord of the Rings is longer. So you solved the problem of length by breaking it up into chunks that left time for discussion and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of chunks did you chop it up to?
Well, with The Lord of the Rings, they were pretty small chunks. You know, we might watch a 5-minute scene and talk about it.
Really?
5-minute scene. But
That's really interesting, Father. I've never heard of anybody except in a film class do that.
But there were other scenes, that, like big battles, that you just have to watch the whole thing.
Did you fast forward?
No, never did that. But we stop maybe at a certain point and watch a documentary too. You know, mm-hmm. So they would have different things to think about. As
you know, I think I think that's something our listeners should think about, whether, you know, they're in classes like this or want to teach them or would like their parish to give them, is that you don't have to sit there and watch a 90-minute movie and burn the whole evening because people want to go home after 90 minutes. You can just pick the best scene or scenes, or even, as you say, watch the movie through in chunks and actually have a serious encounter with the movie and each other.
After The Lord of the Rings, though, when they said, well, what are you going to do next? I said, well, let's watch religious movies. I figured, well, 90 minutes is about all they can take. And so if the movie was 3 hours long, I would always show it in 2 weeks. But even when it was like 2 hours long, I might show 1 hour 1 week and 1 hour the next week. And they started to complain about that because they didn't like cliffhangers.
Huh.
So
no religious movie's a cliffhanger, right? I mean, we know what happens.
The longest I will hold them for now is 2.5 hours.
You get them, do they have any energy left to discuss after 2.5 hours?
Not much. They're ready to go home. But, you know, they all say, well, that was good. And, you know, I said, okay, good night.
Well, what kind of movies did you go to after that? What was your lineup?
In the beginning, I didn't have a library of movies, but I borrowed some and started to acquire some. So it was a little bit more helter-skelter. We always follow a chronological order of subjects. We start with the Old Testament period, and it doesn't have to do with the age of the movie, but just the age of the subject, you know. So we start with Old Testament, we go to New Testament times and ancient time, medieval times, work our way to modern and contemporary times. And within that sequence, usually I have themes that overlap several movies. One year we watch two movies about Joan of Arc. Another year we watch two movies about Saint Therese of Lisieux.
That's wonderful. What a wonderful idea.
The Miracle of Fatima.
Now, did you watch the great silent film with Joan of Arc?
Which one?
Passion of Joan with the famous Carl von Dreyer.
I have several Joan of Arc movies.
I'll tell you, just for the record, I think it's the greatest religious movie ever made. I don't think there's even anything close to it.
Yeah.
And that was 1928, Carl von Dreyer. It was made in France.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who played Joan was a cabaret singer. It was the only movie she ever made.
I showed the one with Lili Sobieski and the one with Mila Jovovich.
I've not seen those. How do they stand up?
Well, the one with Lili Sobieski is much more pious and down to earth. The one with Mila Jovovich is pretty bizarre and gruesome. It might be a little more historically accurate in some things, but it's also more artistic in that Dustin Hoffman plays almost like her conscience, you know.
That's interesting. So, you know, I haven't watched those movies precisely because who starred in them. I mean, they're lovely ladies and they're good actresses, and I've seen them in many other films, but I just couldn't see them playing Joan.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm wrong.
Right, well, and then there's the Otto Preminger one.
Yes, the one with the very beautiful Jean Seberg.
Where she almost...
Or, no, Ingrid Bergman, I'm sorry, with Ingrid Bergman.
She was burned alive in the scene.
And how does that movie come off, the Preminger one with Bergman?
Well, the Preminger one is... It's kind of strange because it's... The king is looking back in time. He's visited by the saint, like in his dream, you know, and he's reviewing her life, and it's a different approach.
By the way, Father, I was right the first time. It is Jean Seberg. I don't know why I questioned my own certainty on that. But Preminger was a serious guy who liked to challenge censorship laws. mm-hmm. like to push the envelope. Does he do it in that St. John?
He does, but not like in The Cardinal or something like that, you know.
Where which in itself is an interesting film. We won't, let's not get sidetracked.
Mm-hmm.
So you now have been doing this for 7 years. And how often do you do it at your parish?
Well, I'm a big baseball fan. So the first movie begins after the last pitch of the World Series, and the last movie ends before the first pitch of the season. And these two seasons, movies and baseball, then are like the two solstices of the planet. But honestly, we always end on the Sunday before Passion Sunday. So we go from the beginning of November to somewhere at the end of March. Every Sunday except the Sunday before and after Christmas Day.
You are a poet. No one else would have put the made the solstice image. I'm talking with Father Jerry Lessard, a Dominican priest. He is at the parish in downtown D.C. near the Federal Center, St. Dominic's. If you're ever in D.C., it's a great place to go to Mass if you're visiting here. And you should walk up and say, "Deal Hudson told me to say hi to you." And you'll find Father Jerry a very welcoming person and lots of fun to be with, but also great conversation partner. Were there any films that you've shown that were just duds?
Oh, yes. In fact, it doesn't have to be good and enjoyable to be effective. There's definitely anyone who takes an objective view of the movies realizes that the quality of the production is not directly proportional to the benefit of the viewer. Although blockbusters are spectacular and captivating to the eyes, they might also be dissatisfying to the soul, whereas a poor production might teach us a great deal. You know, typically Ridley Scott makes our eyes pop with Kingdom of Heaven. But are we any
which was about the Crusades?
But are we any better for it? You know,
right.
On the other hand, Angels with Dirty Faces must have cost much less to make back in 1938. But that old black and white film with James Cagney and Pat O'Brien is one of the most inspiring of all time.
Yes, and a lot of the films that were made during the time of the movie system. When movies were churned out under the great production houses like MGM and Warner Brothers and Fox and so forth, there were some people behind those films, often Jewish, by the way, who, like Cecil B. DeMille and like Ascurus at Fox and Zanuck, they wanted to tell stories that would, in fact, lift people up.
Exactly. I mean, today, there's a lot of new movies coming out that are religious.
There are. You can hardly keep track of them.
But we saw how controversial Noah was. And
for good reason, don't you think?
Mm-hmm, sure.
I mean, my take on it was Transformers meets Abraham and Isaac.
Well, actually, those Nephilim, I was glad to see they were in there because there's so many parts of Scripture that we don't hear about in the lectionary and people don't know about, but they're in the lectionary. Now, his understanding of what the Nephilim were, these giant people, you know, was an odd interpretation.
Well, it was made to attract the mass audience and to make a connection to a great series of movies, very successful Transformers. They look just like
it. That can give me an opportunity to refer to Genesis 6 and say, see, there are these people are mentioned, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What were they really like? Is this, you know, scriptural legend or is there some...
So you give that movie a few more marks than I do, I think.
And, what was it? His grandfather's name, Methuselah or whatever.
Methuselah, yeah. Anthony Hopkins.
You know, and he's like the oldest guy in the Bible. the guy who lived longer than anybody.
But he looked it in the movie, I'll tell you.
So people say, you know, he's as old as Methuselah or whatever, you know.
Well, I think that, you know, Noah was a good but flawed movie. But, you know, a few minutes left before we break. When you first saw the Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, what was your reaction?
Well, I thought it was very accurate. Jesus didn't speak Latin, or maybe Jesus didn't...
No, it was Aramaic.
You know, but the way he conversed with Pilate, and I thought it was very moving, because I never liked softening it too much, you know, where Jesus just has little scratches on.
Oh, man, yeah, they didn't soften it, did they?
No, they didn't. They showed you just about what it really was like.
A lot of critics described that movie as actual sadistic in its treatment of the scourging scene.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a sadistic quality, which they then attributed, of course, to Mel Gibson's, you know, whatever's going on inside his head.
Yeah.
Which I think is unfair to do that. But I want to come back to this and other movies about Christ, of which there are four or five very famous ones. After this short break, I'm talking with Father Jerry Lazard, Dominican priest, downtown D.C. His church is near the Federal Center at St. Dominic's. Next time you're in D.C., you should go by, go to Mass, and say hello to Father Jerry, and blame it on me. We'll be back right after this break.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Catholics believe families are to be communities of love, but it's hard to be a loving community if a family doesn't spend any time together. A recent daycare study highlights this. In Quebec, for over a decade now, families can take advantage of very inexpensive daycare, and almost everyone does. But recently, researchers found that kids in Quebec are significantly more anxious and depressed than they were before universal daycare. Moreover, they're much worse off than kids in other Canadian provinces whose parents don't have such ready access to universal daycare programs. Even more shocking, couples in Quebec report much less happiness with their marriages since daycare became the norm. Sometimes daycare is necessary, but it's never what's best for families. If you use daycare and don't have to, you might be missing more than you think. Come home. The satisfaction will be worth the sacrifice. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. This weekend we observe Mother's Day. It is an opportunity not only to thank our mothers and to thank the Lord for them, but also to pray for all mothers who are afraid to be mothers. So many are already mothers and are just finding out that they are carrying their child within them. They need our encouragement and support, no matter how unplanned, surprising, or shocking the pregnancy may be to them or to us. The fact that motherhood begins before the mother realizes it reminds us of Jesus' words, "It was not you who chose me, it was I who chose you, to go forth and bear fruit that will last." God's choice always comes before ours. When He chooses that someone is to be a mother, let's respond with joyful support. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm back with Father Jerry Lazard, Dominican priest, who at his parish in downtown D.C., St. Dominic's, has been offering film classes and discussions since 2007 when he started with the Lord of the Rings. Father Jerry, I warned you I was going to ask you this, but what is your favorite, personal favorite, religious film?
I just adore The Song of Bernadette. Maybe because I'm French, I don't know. I've been to Lourdes. I wrote a poem called Lourdes. And it just makes me cry every time I see it. I probably saw it a dozen times and cried every time.
So this is a film, just to remind our listeners, was made in 1943 during World War II. It stars Jennifer Jones, Charles Bickford, And it was directed by a very well-known, iconic director, Henry King. And it's got a very fine film score, I believe, by Max Steiner. I'll have to check that. But what it was also based upon a famous European novel by the Catholic convert Franz Werfel. But what is it about that film that gets to you so much? Have you ever asked yourself?
Well, the way they portray it in the story is she just wanted to be a simple woman like her mother and get married and have children. And because of circumstances, she has to go off to the convent, and she's in the wagon with the nuns, and she sees the man she probably would have spent her life with on the side of the road, and he gives her a flower or something. And then he says, I've decided I won't get married either, you know?
You know, the film score, beautiful, was by Alfred Newman. The thing that I remember from that movie, from the times I've seen it, is the figure of Vincent Price playing the prosecutor, the one who is, you know, trying to discredit her visions. What did you think of how Vincent Price played his role?
He just has a wonderful way of being the bad guy, you know, his facial expression, his voice. But then you see his great conversion at the end where he says, Saint Bernadette, pray for me, you know.
Well, maybe that's one reason it's so powerful, because here you have a credible skeptic who is of high intelligence, and we all know Vincent Price was a very cultured and highly educated man, who is overcome by her goodness. Maybe that's part of the formula.
What I love, too, is that the parish priest is... That's the way priests were supposed to be, I think, you know.
Played by Bickford, Charles Bickford.
Strong man. Everybody respected him and obeyed him. And yet he has a tender side and a very loving, compassionate side. He takes care of her, you know. So he's strict, but it's because it's for her benefit, you know. And so it's just a wonderful priest in that.
Just like you. Now, you have another favorite, which you tell me that no one's heard of. It's called Evangeline. Tell me about that.
Well, Evangeline, the musical in concert, was broadcast on PBS, and I watched it on TV one night, and at the end of the program, they said, you know, write to this address or call this number, and you can order a copy of it. And I got an old VHS tape. Well, in my movie seminar, I always use DVDs, and eventually they did come out with DVDs of it. It's about Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's epic poem, Evangeline. But they do it on a stage and with a full concert orchestra and with great singers, and they act out the story with these wonderful songs. And that, too, always brings me to tears.
Well, let me give our listeners a little more info about it, since they might want to look it up. It's entitled Evangeline with an E, a musical in concert. It was broadcast in 2000, and on the International Movie Database, it has a 7.7 rating, which is quite high, and it is available on DVD, Evangeline the Musical. I'm going to order it because you know me, Father Jerry. If it's good and it's recommended from you, I'm going to watch it.
Well, I've been up to those places in Nova Scotia that were taken away from the Acadians. It was called Acadia. I descend from that blood. My ancestors were not sent down to New Orleans and became Cajuns, but they were dropped off in Massachusetts and worked their way back to Canada. But they were my ancestors that had to suffer this, and that's when they changed it to New Scotland, Nova Scotia. But they were treated like slaves. And
right.
when I showed that movie, there was a very intelligent black woman from the Third Order, Dominican Third Order, who was watching, and she was just amazed. She didn't know that whites were treated like black slaves back in the 18th century right here in Canada, you know, put on slave ships and separated from children, from parents and husbands, from wives, and she was shocked by that, so she did further research into it.
Well, I hope that those that are listening will track that down. Now, of course, movies like Song of Bernadette are easily found, and you have a Gregory Peck favorite that you would like to talk about. Tell us about that.
The Keys of the Kingdom, where he goes off to China to be a missionary. And no one expects him to succeed because he has a kind of unorthodox way of doing things. One of his best friends is an atheist physician, but he somehow he gets the support of the local noblemen, and so he fills his school with children, and the nuns come to help. But the Mother Superior is sort of the antagonist.
Right.
They don't get along. But after being there for generations, and now they're both very old, you could tell that they've come to love each other. And she's really sad to see him go back to the homeland.
By the way, just it's interesting that Song of Bernadette was made the year before, also by Fox. This was made in 1944 by Fox and has screen credits. It started from an A.J. Cronin novel, who used to be a very well-known British novelist. But no less than Joseph Mankiewicz and Nunnally Johnson, two of the best screenwriters who we've had come out of this country, did the script. And you've got veteran actors like Gregory Peck. You've got Vincent Price again in this movie. And the great Irish actor, Thomas Mitchell. It looks like Roddy McDowall probably made his screen debut. And then Edmund Gwenn, who played, you know, Santa Claus in the famous Christmas movie, Miracle on, was it 42nd Street? During the days of the studio system, they had all these elements they could put together. And if they could put it together right, they can make a movie which now at 70 years later, still is moving.
And at the end of the movie, when he's sort of under examination, they wonder whether they should put him out to pasture or take his faculties away or something. But he leaves his biography out, his notes, and so all night long, the priest who came to investigate is reading his life story and finds out what a real great man he really is. And so he tells him, you know, everything's going to be okay. And then so Gregory Peck gets his fishing pole and goes off with the little boy. You know, it's just wonderful.
Now, you have another film on your favorite list, which surprises me. It's a 1940 movie. It's a gangster movie called Brother Orchid. And it stars no less than Edward G. Robinson and Humphrey Bogart. Now, tell us about Brother Orchid.
It was a providential coincidence that my movie theme this past season was about religious life, because it turned out that the Pope made this the year of religious life. So this is about a gangster, Edward G. Robinson, who sort of leaves the organization for a while because he wants to find class. And Humphrey Bogart takes over. But when he comes back, he's on the outside.
Right.
Being chased. And he goes through the woods and he gets shot. And he ends up at a monastery where they grow flowers. And they don't ask any questions about your past. So he just becomes Brother Orchid.
Oh.
And he loves living in this monastery.
By the way, Edward G. Robinson is kind of like Vincent Price. They had these sort of villainous characters they played, but Robinson was an art connoisseur, a collector, a man of deep culture and education.
He didn't always like being a gangster.
No, and when he's given a role like this, where it opens up into something spiritual, I haven't seen this one, but I'm guessing he's very powerful.
It's got action, it's got comedy, and Southern is just marvelous with her.
Oh, she's great.
Her New York accent, and she's like the dumb blonde, but she's smarter than everybody else. And it's hysterical. And
by the way, it's got a 7.1 rating on IMDb.com, which is pretty much the standard for going on the Internet, finding information about movies, but also about their relative the relative respect they have. So I'm going to put that. I actually own that movie and haven't watched it yet, so my son and I will be probably watching that this evening. Now, you have one more. I asked you, what was your favorite Jesus movie? And you answered the famous Jesus of Nazareth by directed by Franco Zeffirelli.
Yes. Too many Jesus movies in recent years have what you would call a low Christology. You know, they try to make Jesus look more human by giving him the flaws of fallen nature or taking some of his divinity away. But you don't have that with Jesus of Nazareth.
Which, by the way, was a two-part miniseries on TV. I had forgotten that.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was came in 1977, and the Christ was the British actor Robert Powell. He had a very, very arresting face, did he not?
He did. And he did, but it was loaded with stars. Sir Laurence Olivier, and it was just...
Well, the list is, I got Anne Bancroft, Ernest Borgnine, I've got Christopher Plummer, Olivia Hussey played the Virgin Mary, of course, a famous Juliet from years.
Mm-hmm.
Michael York, Claudia Cardinale, of course, James Mason, Anthony Quinn, Rod Steiger, and it just goes on and on and on.
On and on. And this year I showed Romeo and Juliet by Zeffirelli, and it has Michael York in it, and like you say...
Yeah, he plays the brother who tries to protect... Tybalt. He plays Tybalt, trying to protect Juliet. Why, though, some people think that Zeffirelli's Virgin is too lush, too beautiful in a way. I mean, if you compare it with even Passion of the Christ, or more pertinently, Pasolini's The Gospel of St. Matthew, it is the most visually stunning of all these movies. Is that inappropriate for the life and death and of Christ?
It's his film style. You could take a Zeffirelli film and stop it anywhere, and you're looking at a painting.
Right.
For example, like at the Visitation, when you see the Blessed Virgin Mary and St. Elizabeth and the people in the background, everything in the background of the picture was painted there almost, you know, by...
Well, it's like he used the Renaissance painters as his model, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he... I must say that I think that level of attention to design and color and so forth is entirely appropriate to the telling this story. As long as you say, you don't soften it up too much. Do you think there was any softening here in the depiction of Christ?
At the time, back in the 70s, it was probably thought to be a little less divine than we would expect. But by today's standards, that's not true.
Ernest Borgnine is the centurion, and here's another example of a tough guy like Edward G. Robinson undergoing a conversion in a very powerful way.
Mm-hmm.
Great casting, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about Michael York, and I just saw something that he's in, and it's unlike any other movie I have ever seen. It's called The Mill and the Cross, and it's about a Dutch painter at the time of the hostilities that flared mm-hmm. between the Spanish rulers and the Calvinists mm-hmm. in the 16th century. And there's hardly any dialogue in the whole film.
I have seen this film. It's by Lech Majewski, and it's one of the most visually beautiful films I've ever seen.
Yeah, the photography and the special effects, and it's almost like everybody in the painting comes alive and you see their backstory.
Well, the painting is Bruegel, a Bruegel painting,
mm-hmm.
And the whole narrative emerges out of that painting, and it's almost replicated, right,
mm-hmm.
on the screen. And did you think it succeeded as a religious film?
Well, it doesn't really express one opinion. I think it's more Protestant than Catholic. You know, it shows that the Catholics were persecuting the Calvinists, but it gives me an opportunity to teach them some history about that period.
And did that film? That film's very slow moving, and it's an art film, the kind of which a lot of people groan about watching. Did you find that that film kind of left anybody behind, as it were?
Well, I hope to show it in the next season. I just saw it myself
recently,
and shared it with a couple of people, and they loved it. You know.
You think that, that among serious Catholics and evangelicals, I mean, people who worry about cultural matters, there's always these kind of dismissive comments about Hollywood and the movies. I sense you don't care, you don't share that dismissal.
Oh no, I have a lot of biblical films, and some of them are made by real fundamentalists, and they stick very close to the scriptures. And others are real Hollywood productions that, well, the scriptures are only remotely connected to the story. And we show them. You know, for example, the two Esther movies that I showed one time, one was very close to the scriptures, and the other one was a real Hollywood production. But the Hollywood ones are more fun to watch, but you can compare and contrast them, you know. You say, well, I like this about this one, but I didn't like this about the other one, you know, and so forth.
You're saying basically they're better made.
They have a plot, you know. There's a conclusion to it. It's like the life of a saint.
Yeah, they're not as didactic as the kind of movies that
those are the most boring movies. If it's just following the biography, strict, because the life of the saint didn't have a climax necessarily, or it didn't have the low point that you come out of, you know. And so,
do you find that there's a flaw? Is this a similar flaw that you find in a lot of the movies made expressly for the Christian market? Of course, one of the great exceptions would be the wonderful treatment of the C.S. Lewis Narnia series that was done, you know, as directly for the large Christian and socially conservative audience in this country. But I often find that movies made for that market are just preaching at me things I already believe in.
Well, there's two series of Bible films that I've used. One is called The Bible Stories, and another one is called The Bible Collection. One is, I think, a Sony corporation, and they're a little bit more artistic. And the other one is more of a fundamentalist approach, and yet they're pretty well done. They're entertaining, and they have good actors. F. Murray Abraham appears in.
Yeah, he's in the Esther film.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you know, Roma Downey and her husband have, as you know, gotten into this side of movie producing. What did you think of their The Bible miniseries of a couple of years ago?
Well, I only saw the Son of God part. They created a theatrical.
Yeah, that was kind of the follow up to the miniseries. Mm-hmm. What did you think of it?
Well, we had our house lector chose that show to the community, and we got the whole community together to talk about it. And I thought it was. I thought Jesus was not really divine enough. He seemed to be trying to figure himself out, and other people were trying to, like the Blessed Virgin was kind of pushing him along, as if he wasn't perfect yet, and he's.
Well, let me tell you, it's interesting. I'm looking at IMDb, Father, and it's only got a 5.5 rating. Mm-hmm. And that's from over 13,000 viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And the percentage of critics who liked it was only about 30%. So that, it doesn't look, it looks like your kind of muted reaction to it is kind of reflected in the general reception of it.
Yeah, well, it didn't turn me. I have avoided a lot of Jesus movies in my series because there's too many interpretations of Jesus. But I have had movies that were completely different. Like I showed Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell,
which, by the way, I really like. I must confess, it's a guilty pleasure. I like that movie.
Oh yeah, but I've shown movies where Jesus is sort of a main character, but not the central one. Like there was a movie about Judas that I showed, and another one called The Final Inquiry, where a Roman tribune mm-hmm. is going to investigate whether this guy really rose from the dead,
By the way, I want to interrupt you. For those who are listening who may be upset with us for not liking Son of Man, if you go back to the original miniseries produced by Roma Downey and her husband, it got a 7.4 rating from nearly 7,000 viewers. So there seems to be a difference in quality. By the way, did you ever see the great Anthony Quinn play Barabbas?
Oh, yes. I showed that to my class years ago. And he often is in religious films, except for when he was the Pope in
Think about it.
Jesus. I'm trying to remember. Except for when he was the Pope, he's usually the bad guy,
yes.
in the religious movie. This coming year, the Pope is coming to America, and he's going to canonize Junipero Serra.
Right.
So I hope to show the movie Seven Cities of Gold with Anthony Quinn. And it's about.
Does he play Serra there or another character?
No, he plays sort of a conquistador. But it's a pretty obscure movie. It was hard.
You're thinking of Shoes of the Fisherman, Anthony Quinn, 1968.
That's right. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Where he's playing playing Archbishop Lakota. And there may have been another film where he played a pope, but this is what I'm finding. That's the one sort of clerical role that I connect to Anthony Quinn.
Mm-hmm. But he has played a bad guy in religious films. For example, the one about the Spanish Civil War, where he's Behold the Pale Horse.
Yeah.
That was the only movie I've ever seen Gregory Peck as a bad guy. Well, Gregory Peck and Anthony Quinn and Omar Sharif plays the priest in that.
Really?
And Behold a Pale Horse is a very difficult film to watch. You don't walk away with a big smile on your face.
Mm-hmm.
That was satisfying. But there's some good performances in it.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, and I'm going to insist you write something about this at the Christian Review so other people can benefit from your experience. And I want to also thank you for mentioning the film about Junipero Serra. Could you give the title of that again?
It's called Seven Cities of Gold.
Well, that's something that we'll leave our listeners with that. Look that one up on the occasion of our Holy Father coming to this country and also canonizing that great saint. Father Jerry Lazard, it was wonderful to have you on Church and Culture. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have you back once you've watched another batch of movies. And to all of you who are listening, I have another great guest around the corner. Please stay with us, and after this break, I'll introduce you to him.
St. Thomas Church in Ann Arbor just observed the 40th anniversary of Humanae Vitae with a talk by Dr. Janet Smith.
The other day, Al Cresta on the radio asked me, he said, what was it about the times that made people so resistant to Humanae Vitae? But let's review for ourselves and maybe introduce some others to what was going on. Of course, Vatican II had happened earlier, and it opened the windows of the church to the modern world and had lots of change and changed the Mass from Latin to the vernacular. No more fasting on Fridays. And people thought, well, the church is just going to keep changing. We know how much change is going to happen.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Sacred Heart Major Seminary Chair of Life Ethics Janet Smith was the guest of the Respect Life Group at St. Thomas the Apostle Church in Ann Arbor. She spoke on Pope Paul's sixth Humanae Vitae and the attitude of the U.S. in 1968. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Do word problems stump your math student? Professor Fred Wirth says that following a few simple steps can help your student easily decipher any puzzling word problem. That's next on Homeschool Heartbeat.
Fred, we've been talking this week about why kids might struggle in math. Tell the parents listening what they can do to bring up their students' math performance.
Well, the ability to problem solve is vital to success in mathematics, whether we're talking about taking standardized tests or just learning mathematics in homeschool. Not all problems on tests are word problems, but they are very important. The first word problems come up in first grade, where Mary has some apples and Johnny gives her some more. Nobody has any trouble with those, but each year the word problems get tougher until you have one train leaving Boston at 10 a.m. and another train leaving Cleveland at 11 a.m. Most people have a difficult time solving the more complicated problems because they've never really been instructed in problem-solving techniques. There's a method that I teach that can really help in learning how to do word problems. And, Mike, I believe you'll be telling people how to contact you in order to get a copy of this. The first step is just read the problem. Second is to think about the problem. Then determine what's important, drawing a picture and labeling the picture. Then finding the formula, which is where most people try to start, and adapting the formula to the problem, solving the equation, answering the question, and then thinking about whether the answer makes sense. And this method can go a long way in teaching your child how to be a better problem solver, not just in mathematics, but in life.
Well, those are great suggestions, Fred. Thanks for sharing them with us. And until next time, I'm Mike Smith.
If you've appreciated this week's program, you might like to receive Dr. Wirth's resource sheet on teaching math. You can get your free copy by visiting us at homeschoolheartbeat.com. And if you'd like to receive Homeschool Heartbeat's daily email transcript, visit our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com or call us toll-free at 1-866-338-8614.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get